Welcome to the History section. Here, we explore the hidden facets of history that have shaped our world, uncovering insights and perspectives that traditional narratives often miss. Whether you're a history buff or just curious about the past, join us as we connect the dots between the past and the present, understanding how history influences the world we live in. Okay, welcome back to the History section. I have my very first guest, Peter Kornbluh, author of The Pinochet File, and I believe you're a senior analyst at the NSA, correct?
Well, the NSA means different things to different people. Most people think of it as the National Security Agency, which is the most secretive U.S. government agency on the planet. That's not us. We are the antithesis of that. We're the National Security Archive, not to be confused with the other NSA. We are a non-government, non-profit, transparency research center focusing on the right to know and declassify documents. And we try to get the secrets of state declassified and into the hands of young people like you and many, many others around the world who can benefit from knowing what U.S. policy was, policies that were done in our name, but often without our knowledge. We don't really refer to ourselves as the NSA because it confuses us with the U.S. government agency that is the agency that intercepts your emails and listens in on your telephone calls. That's not us.
Yeah, I'd figure I'd hit you with that curveball at the beginning, because when I initially had looked you up, it said, analyst at the NSA, and I thought, what? So I figured it'd be important for people to get that clarification if they ever hear to the National Security Archives referred to as the NSA.
Yeah, we just call ourselves the Archive.
The Archive. That's a good name.
Yeah.
Cool. First, I wanted you to kind of touch on your background just as a historian and kind of learn what influenced you to pursue history.
Well, my mother was a historian. She was a labor historian and focusing on kind of radical labor movements like the Industrial Workers of the World. She wrote a number of books, pretty famous book on the IWW called Rebel Voices. But she wrote a number of other books on labor movements and women in labor movements. In some ways I've followed in her footsteps as a historian. The thing is that I'm not really exclusively a historian. I'm also a journalist. I'm also a foreign policy analyst. I've had a kind of a multi-layered career, if you will, and multifaceted, and that makes it, continues to make it very, very interesting. My interest in Chile, which is, I think, what you want to explore, actually began with, not surprisingly, a Chilean girl.
Oh, man.
Who I met when she was just 15 years old. I was just 17 years old, and I met her the day after the coup, 50 years ago, on September 12th, 1973, in my first hour high school class. And that meeting, that first kind of interaction between us, really led to the personal life I've had and the professional life I've had. And it was through her that I first learned the horrors of the coup and kind of developed an interest in Chile and the United States and the U.S. role in the events that took place there, some 50 years ago, the events that I wrote about in my book, The Pinochet File.
And what conversations did you have with that girl that resonated? Was it just hearing about the atrocities committed by the Pinochet regime, or just her personal hardships?
Well, that first day, the Pinochet regime had been a regime for all of 24 hours.
Yeah.
And, what I heard from her, and she actually didn't tell it to me. She refused to talk to me about it, but she started talking to the teacher about it.
Oh.
What I heard was a family in pain that had been up all night trying to reach their relatives in Santiago to make sure everybody was okay, that their president was dead, that there were bodies floating down the river in the middle of the city, people were being killed right and left. And the promise of kind of social democracy that Salvador Allende, the president who had died and been overthrown, it was gone, crushed. Mm-hmm. And that's what I learned basically that very first day. But over the course of time, she and I hooked up, as the kids say, and became a serious couple. moved to Washington together in 1979, got married, had a child, unfortunately got divorced under the pressures of professional pressures of Washington life. But we worked on Chile together for many, many, many years. And from my relationship with her, I developed my interest in studying what the United States had done in Chile. At that point in 1973, we really didn't know about the U.S. role. And it wasn't until September of 1974, as I began my first year of college, that the intrepid, famous investigative reporter Seymour Hersh broke the story of CIA destabilization against Allende in Chile. And that story, and then the subsequent creation of the famous Senate committee led by Senator Frank Church that investigated the CIA role in Chile and basically exposed all the things the CIA had done around the world that the American public was not the least bit aware of, including assassinating, you know, foreign leaders, overthrowing, you know, other governments, assassinating other leaders, subverting, you know, the economies and political systems of numerous countries. All those things are basically unknown at the time. They're well known now, and the world has changed considerably 50 years later. But none of this was known, and I just started focusing on that very issue, and then the issue of human rights became a prominent issue because of Henry Kissinger's embrace of the violent, murderous Pinochet regime, and I joined the human rights movement along with my wife Adriana, the Chilean, and we worked very hard for the cause of human rights and the return of democracy in Chile. And now 50 years have gone by, and there's a lot of history there, but it's a history that is incredibly relevant to today's world.
That was the that relevance was why I reached out to you initially, because I think that we can learn so much from CIA subversion and U.S. interventionism, specifically in the Latin world, because I think it's defined so many, not just political attitudes, but I think sort of created so many situations that the American public is ignorant of. I think of Venezuela, for example, where we sort of many people refer to, you know, the crisis in Venezuela and the inflation and the general turmoil as a result of their own policies. And they refused, you know, no one acknowledges or is unaware of, you know, American interventionism into that country and how that contributed to the current situation.
Well, you know, you're talking about Venezuela. 6 million Venezuelans have left Venezuela, mm-hmm. Because the government there has basically self-destroyed its own country between Chavez and Maduro. Sorry to be quite frank about this, but Venezuela was a prosperous country. It was probably the richest country in Latin America as Hugo Chavez started his government there at some 10, 12, 14 years ago. And competing with Brazil kind of for influence in the region. At one point, Venezuela was giving more foreign aid to the other countries of Latin America than the United States was. And so it was a very, very important country. But now it's essentially a failed state. It is under severe U.S. Economic sanctions, and that hasn't helped. They have a very anti-humanitarian bent to them that has contributed to the economic decline. But for the most part, it's the self-destruction of their own oil industry, because all the professionals who have ran it have now fled the country. But those 6 million people have fanned out across the world, particularly across Latin America. The migration pressure that 6 million Venezuelans have brought to other countries have created a huge ripple effect in countries like Chile, where just like in the United States, where migration, immigrants are blamed for rising crime rates. Rising crime rates lead to kind of a reaction in the society of distrust in the government, demands for law and order translate into, you know, empowering the extreme right wing of societies, just like, you know, Donald Trump showed us here in the United States. And so you have countries like Chile that are facing kind of a rising call for a return to the, you know, authoritarian era of the Pinochet dictatorship, And that's very, very threatening. It's threatening to Chileans. It's threatening, you know, that phenomena to our own country, quite frankly. And that's why, you know, your generation is reading stories about, you know, coup attempts in the United States and the threat of authoritarianism if Donald Trump manages to get himself reelected, and kind of just the sense of disintegrating strength of the pillars of democracy in the United States, which for all this time up until recently were thought to be sacrosanct and impenetrable, but they turn out to be vulnerable and even in a weakening state now, which is very, very alarming, and a phenomena that's in other countries as well. But let me go back to your point now that we've talked about Venezuela. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole issue of U.S. intervention in Latin America was in the 1800s, most of the 20th century and early in the 21st century, you know, a significant phenomena. And it's a history that was created that still has a lot of kind of resonance and impact today. For example, in Cuba, just the day before you and I are speaking, the United Nations voted 187 countries to two being United States and Israel, to condemn the U.S. embargo on Cuba, which has also hurt the country economically for many, many years. Led to mass migration of Cubans abroad, and just seems anti-humanitarian and completely unjust. And that's why, you know, the vast, vast majority of the world, we're talking 99.8% of countries around the world, you know, believing that the embargo should be condemned and voting that way at the United Nations. And that, you know, that whole issue of the embargo takes us all the way back to the Bay of Pigs invasion and U.S. covert efforts to assassinate Fidel Castro and roll back the Cuban Revolution. And so, you know, this is still a history that's there and still affecting the world. The 50th anniversary of the coup in Chile, which was strongly backed by Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger at the time, consolidation of the Pinochet regime with Kissinger and Nixon's support. Those are still issues that resonate in U.S.-Chilean relations. And basically, all of Latin America has this kind of history with the United States that still is so present in relations today.
Yeah, that actually leads me to a question I had. In your book, on the 27th page, you coin a phrase which I'm sure has been used before, but I had never heard it, called fiduciary responsibility. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Fiduciary
responsibility. Okay. I'm good at writing, not speaking. You know, an imperial sense of obligation and entitlement held by the United States to subvert Chilean democracy. But that's an attitude that they approached, I think, the greater Latin world with, and just foreign relations and foreign policy in general. Could you delve further into detail about America's fiduciary responsibility during the Cold War, I guess, as it pertains to Latin America?
You know, it's not only a Cold War phenomena. It's a phenomenon in the current era. The reason that Vladimir Putin and Russia are so brutally, maliciously, and murderously, you know, invading and attacking the Ukraine is because Russia, as a behemoth nation, as a major nation in that region of the world, believes that it has the might and the right to control the societies in its kind of neighborhood, in its kind of area of influence, and the United States had exercise the exact same attitude towards Latin America, starting all the way back with the Monroe Doctrine 200 years ago. We're coming up on the 200th anniversary of the Monroe Doctrine. The Monroe Doctrine basically said the United States is the only country that can exercise influence in the Western Hemisphere. All other nations, be warned that you're not welcomed here and your influence will be turned back militarily, if necessary. And that was a warning to the European countries, France, Spain, England, Holland, you know, any of the countries that had already colonized parts of Latin America. And that the United States no longer wanted to deal with their influence in the region. And so they were warned and pushed out. And that expanded, that attitude expanded into the Cold War, which was basically to push out and reject any influence of the Soviet Union after World War II. Although, actually, the kind of Cold War arguments that we're familiar with really started after right around World War I, when the Bolsheviks took power in Russia before the Soviet Union was even created. And U.S. presidents, starting with Calvin Coolidge, started to, you know, in the early 1930s, started to argue that it was Bolsheviks that were spreading revolution in Latin America. And so we had to send the Marines into countries like Nicaragua and defeat Augusto Sandino, the first guy to kind of fight the Marine occupation in Nicaragua, because he was being manipulated by the Bolsheviks. This, of course, was a complete farce and fantasy and lie, but it was an argument that then became very prominent as it expanded, as we entered the Cold War and the fight against the Soviet Union. And basically, your reference to fiduciary responsibility is another way of U.S. officials saying that they have what political scientists call the hegemonic presumption of control over what pejoratively Latin America was known as our backyard. And that's because the United States was the hegemonic power in the region, and therefore it presumed to sustain that hegemony by hook or by crook. You know, could be by economic aid, or it could be by covert operations, or it could be by marine invasions or paramilitary invasions, such as the Bay of Pigs in Cuba. So it's the same thing. And in the case of Chile, you're quoting a statement that was made to me when I was essentially your age and doing research for my honors thesis in college on why the United States had intervened to overthrow the Allende government in Chile. And I was interviewing the U.S. ambassador, the former U.S. ambassador to Chile, Edward Corey. And he was explaining to me that in the early 1960s, the Kennedy administration first sent the CIA into Chile to secretly finance paying 50% of the 1964 campaign of the middle-class party, the Christian Democrats, and getting a politician named Eduardo Frei elected. We paid 50% of that campaign. We helped the Christian Democrats buy radio stations, print newspapers. The CIA slapped false black propaganda on the walls of all the neighborhoods around Santiago, Chile, you know, claiming that Salvador Allende, who was running for president then in 1964 for the third time, you know, was going to eat your children if he got elected, all those types of things. And then once we got Eduardo Frei elected, the United States poured more than $1 billion of investments and economic assistance into Chile to turn it into a model for something called the Alliance for Progress, which was a massive economic plan for Latin America that was intended to bolster and expand the middle classes, draw kind of support away from the left, the radical left and the nationalist left in Latin America, and kind of secure for the United States political parties that were pro-American, but also more representative and would be a stronger force against kind of the influence of the left after Fidel Castro's revolution in Cuba in 1959. And that investment in Chile for the Alliance for Progress is what I was being told by the U.S. ambassador, Edward Corey, needed to be protected. It's that the United States had this fiduciary responsibility because it had made this fiduciary investment in Chile to make sure that Allende and the left didn't gain power. And so to protect that investment, we had the responsibility in 1970 when another election came and Allende was running again to make sure that he didn't win. But basically, those two things are related, the hegemonic presumption and the fiduciary responsibility. That was the way the United States and U.S. officials saw the Latin American region in those days. They saw it as kind of a backyard of the United States, which was a great insult to proud countries like Brazil, Chile, Venezuela, et cetera, that they were considered somebody's yard. I have to tell you a little anecdote. I found a declassified document at one point of a
Go for
U.S.
it.
official who was talking to a Peruvian scholar and was writing to protest that President Ronald Reagan, the U.S. official, was writing to his superiors to say, you know, Ronald Reagan in his speeches, you know, about Central America, about the Contra war in Nicaragua, and about El Salvador, he shouldn't refer to this Latin American region is our backyard. You know, I was in this conversation with this Peruvian guy, and he was pointing out to me how insulting it is. And the U.S. official that this guy is writing to writes back and said, "Well, is it okay if Reagan calls it our front yard?" And the answer was, "I don't think Latin America wants to be known as anybody's yard. Why can't you just refer to them as our neighbors?" But that gives you a sense of kind of the attitude of hegemony, the kind of imperial mindedness of policymakers such as Kissinger and Nixon. And that's really the answer to your question. It's the United States has been the hegemonic power in this area since the beginning, and it made a big investment to sustain U.S. control and influence in the region, and that investment helped kind of push the idea that if Chileans freely and democratically wanted to elect a socialist named Salvador Allende, somehow the United States had the right to say, "Oh, well, we don't like that, and we're going to stop that from happening."
It seems that, like, that responsibility and the general notions of hegemony that are reflected in, like, in policy decisions and in, you know, investing all this money into kind of subverting the general democracy of so many countries, it denies equal status, obviously, but I think it also denies a lot of these places their agency by, you know, like Chile is a great example where the country organically elects a socialist president who there's no manipulation. It's just they organically elect a socialist president, and the United States kind of gives itself the right to course correct. Is that kind of how they viewed it?
The United States, U.S. officials, you know, the United States doesn't act as a system. It's made up of individuals who make these decisions. And even though political scientists and international relations theorists, you know, have all sorts of models of how the United States responds as a country in a systems way and the patterns of history, which are very strong, the truth is that when you read the documents of every day, you see that these decisions are not made, you know, kind of 100% with everybody on board. There's people who argue different positions. There's people who resign in protest. There's people who bring their opinion to the table and say this is a bad idea. There's people who resist. But, you know, you have imperially minded officials. In the case of Chile in 1970, 73, U.S. President Nixon, Richard Nixon, and Henry Kissinger, who basically believe that might makes right. Kissinger would argue that this is realpolitik. You know, this is the real way the world works. But there's a morality to the world as well. There's the issue of human rights. There's the issue of international law. There's all sorts of rules and regulations and values and principles. And everything that Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger did in Chile violated those values and principles of the American public. And that is ipso facto why when Seymour Hersh, you know, published this article in September of 1974 in the New York Times about the CIA destabilization campaign in Chile, why this became a massive scandal. Your generation doesn't remember this, but this dominated the whole issue of what the CIA was doing and how unrepresentative it was of what the American public believed the United States should stand for. It was a massive, massive scandal, and it led to the first serious Senate investigation to hold the CIA accountable and to hold U.S. presidents accountable. To end the whole idea that presidents could plausibly deny that they knew anything about these covert operations, for example, and to try and limit these types of operations. That wasn't tremendously successful. in the coming years. We had the Contra War in Nicaragua, which was basically an open, covert paramilitary operation. We had the Iran-Contra scandal. We had the invasion of Panama during the first Bush administration. You know, we had all sorts of interventionist and covert operations that continued on after Chile. But that was the first debate and the first issue that was generated after the coup and after the revelations. So, you know, the whole issue of what our government stands for continues to this very day. You're witnessing it in the whole discussion and debate over the Ukraine and aid to the Ukraine and the war that is now the dreadful situation in the Middle East that's going on right now, as you and I are speaking in November. It's still very, very, very relevant. The only way, frankly, and this gets back to what I do, the only way we're going to have a fully informed and educated debate about what's going on is if we have access to the truth about what our government is doing in our name, but without our knowledge. And that's why we try and get these secret documents declassified as quickly as we can so we can have a fully informed discussion about what the United States is doing and what it should be doing.
And that actually... mentioning those declassified documents leads me to another question. So how did you go about curating, you know, you reference so many different declassified documents. I'm assuming, you know, a plethora of other sources were consulted in your book. But how did you go about curating your list of declassified documents, working through the sort of, you know, blacked out portions of information and extracting the narrative of specifically the Pinochet file?
Well, I knew a lot about Chile because I had written my honors thesis as an undergraduate on the whole issue of why the United States had intervened to overthrow Allende. And then my master's thesis grad school was about the first 10 years of U.S.-Chilean relations with the Pinochet regime, which covered case of everything from the case of Charles Horman, the American who was murdered, disappeared, killed by the Pinochet's forces right after the coup, about whom the movie Missing was made, starring Jack Lemmon and Sissy Spacek, and all the way to the Letelier-Moffat assassination, an act of international terrorism in Washington, D.C., carried out by Pinochet's secret police agents. All those things. So, you know, I already knew quite a bit about U.S.-Chilean relations. But what had happened is that Pinochet had finally been arrested. The human rights movement had finally succeeded in cornering him in London. And Spain had asked for him to be arrested in London under the European Counterterrorism Convention, because Pinochet was a terrorist. He was a bloody dictator at home, but he also sent his secret agents out around the world to murder in the most vicious way, car bombs, shooting people in the back on the streets of Rome, etc. So under the Counterterrorism Convention of Europe, which allows countries to help each other to track down and detain terrorists, he was arrested in London in October of 1998. And he was going to be extradited to Spain to stand trial on terrorism and crimes against humanity charges. And that enabled my organization and the families of his most prominent victims, including the family of Charles Horman and the Letelier family and the family of the young woman who was killed with Letelier, Ronnie Moffat, her family, to push the Clinton administration to declassify all the documents in the U.S. archives that were evidence of Pinochet's crimes and atrocities and acts of terrorism. And, you know, that did lead that campaign, which I was very heavily involved in, did lead to the declassification of about 23,000 documents that had never been seen before. Yeah, very important documents, including the CIA operational documents of the efforts to overthrow Salvador Allende. And, you know, somebody had to go through all those documents, so that I decided that somebody should be me, and use them and organize them. And we did that in many, many ways. The whole collection was physically copied, and one set was brought to Chile, another set was brought to my office, another set was put online by the State Department. Many articles were written. We started posting articles, specific documents on our website to generate headlines in Chile and around the world. And then I thought, well, I'll just you know, write a book about this. And if you organize documents the right way and have a good outline, you can use documents to narrate a story. And in this case, the story was 20 years of U.S. involvement in Chile, 1970 to 1990. It was quite a story. And I think the book came out very well. It was first published 20 years ago on the 30th anniversary of the coup in Chile. Then a new edition, which you probably have, was published on the 40th anniversary. And then for this 50th anniversary that just passed in September of 2023, the Chileans decided they would publish a Chilean edition. And I found all sorts of new documents that were very interesting to the Chilean people. And we put those in the new edition of the book. And it created quite a bit of discussion and headlines in Chile. The book was on the bestseller list for almost 5 weeks. It rose to be number two on the bestseller list. And the book that was the only book that beat it that week was a book on BTS. How can you compete with that? You
know? Yeah, that's a little bit beyond the scope of our field, I think.
So, you know, books on the bestseller list are not necessarily books about politics. In this case, a Korean boys band was very, very popular. So anyway, a lot of people read the book. There was a documentary film that was broadcast on Chilean television. More than a million Chileans watched it. Another 500,000 downloaded it afterwards. You know, the documents really played a big role in the current discussion in Chile about who Pinochet was, what his regime really did, the truth as recorded in these secret documents. So, you know, you can tell the story of history with these documents, but you can also make sure that they're used and remembered in the context of the current debate. You know, there's a lot of misinformation out there. There's a lot of disinformation. There's a lot of, can I say, bullshit on your podcast?
There's a lot of bullshit.
From people who want to whitewash and resurrect Pinochet and pretend that he committed no crimes, and even claim that he was a statesman and a Democrat when, in fact, he was a dictator, a corrupt dictator at that, and a terrorist. So, you know, these documents are important for the debate that's going on literally right now in Chile. And equally so, there will be documents in the United States that are absolutely relevant to the debate over Donald Trump and his efforts to whitewash his own crimes and his own coup attempts in the United States. And those are very, very important. So that's why we focus on these documents and try and organize them and call attention to them in a way that has an impact. I like to think of ourselves as activist archivists. We're not content to just get documents and put them in a file and wait for some scholar to come along and look at them. We want to make sure that they attract the attention that they historically deserve. And two, I also think of myself as a forensic historian. We want to dig up, you know, documents and truths that have been buried and use those documents to identify where human rights victims are, who killed them. We want to help the cause of justice and use these documents to support families of victims that, you know, really don't have the information they deserve about what happened, the fate of their loved ones.
Well, I mean, what you do definitely was eye-opening for me. I was aware of who Pinochet was in a very general sense. I knew he was a dictator. I knew he was Chilean. That was about it. So reading your book, and I think not only knowing the atrocities that he had organized and the, you know, the bloody regime that he had kind of marked out for himself in the wake of U.S. intervention, I think that bringing those, that kind of whitewashed history to life is something that continues to be really important, super relevant, especially as we move forward in with, you know, with so much access to information through social media, to where every day you're bombarded with sort of a million different perspectives on a certain event. You mentioned the conflict in the Middle East. That conflict is so, I think, rife with people, and not necessarily even spreading disinformation or misinformation or maliciously astroturfing to kind of evoke a certain response from people, but just people posting what they see and how they interpret information in the moment. You know, I think as of the last couple days, I think towards the end of October, there was a hospital that was destroyed, and I have not even been able to look. You know, I think the jury's still out about whether it was an IDF airstrike. Others were claiming it was a Hamas rocket. The casualties are the number of casualties is ranging from 70 to 500 is what I've heard. And I think a lot of these perspectives aren't, I don't, obviously some people are trying to spread misinformation, but I think a lot of these perspectives are just people with access to the internet just saying how they feel. And I think that is going to change. I think that's going to significantly alter the landscape of like deciphering historic events, specifically, you know, violence and atrocities moving forward, because human beings, we're not machines. You know, we can't perfectly recollect what happened. So I think moving forward, it's important to piece together that, you know, the history of countries like Chile, where their history is so muddied and so complex and hidden behind a lot of black ink and sealed away documents.
Well, let me just say that I'm sure you're aware of the famous expression that the first casualty of war is truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that is absolutely true. There's the fog of war, and there's obviously the interests of those waging the war to cast their actions in the, you know, most positive light, which includes just lying about what those actions are. And the press is often swayed by this, in part because they don't give themselves the time to really look at what happened, and because there's such pressure to get out there and be the first to report on something, even if the initial information is factually incorrect. You know, the fact of the matter is, and we should all remember this, is that governments lie. They just do. And some government officials, Donald Trump being the leader of them all, but Henry Kissinger being a close second, lie a lot. But that's the beauty of declassified documents, which, by the way, the ones that I work with, they were all created before there ever was such a thing as the internet or social media.
Right.
And they still remain what I would call the currency of history, declassified documents. They're not the only way to understand history, but they create a foundation, a historical record that is extremely strong. It allows young people like yourself and your listeners to transport through time via the time machine of declassified documents right back into the Oval Office of Richard Nixon in, you know, September of 1970, where he sits with the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Richard Helms, and with his top aide on national security, Henry Kissinger, and tells, you know, the CIA to go into Chile and make sure that Allende never even becomes president. You literally can be a spy on, be a spider, be a fly on the wall of the Oval Office, or you can go and hang out in the CIA operational headquarters and read the cables that are going back and forth to from Langley headquarters to the Santiago station of the CIA on, you know, how to actually conduct a regime change operation against the Allende government. So they just become invaluable, and they carry a gravitas, a weight that really does help the discussion, the interminable opinion and misinformation and disinformation and garbage that a lot of people throw up on the internet, either for self-serving individual reasons or for political purpose, which is to manipulate the narrative about what's really happening. And of course, governments have all sorts of devoting all sorts of resources to manipulating the internet and social media to cast themselves in the best possible light. You know, I'm a big advocate of people, particularly young people like yourself, reading declassified documents, using these documents for your understanding of history, learning about the U.S. officials and others that you are interested in through the documents that they read and they wrote, because these reflect generally their real opinions at the time. I mean, we literally have the phone conversations between Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger discussing the coup in Chile. And that's invaluable. You don't have to rely on the opinion of a historian like myself about what the U.S. role was in Chile. You can literally read what Henry Kissinger says to the President of the United States about how the CIA set the conditions as best as possible for a coup to take place. And Kissinger and Nixon kind of basically commiserating because the liberal press won't give them the credit that they believe they deserve for overthrowing Allende. As Kissinger puts it, you know, in the Eisenhower period, we would be heroes. And that's what they want. They want to be treated as heroes for having overthrown democracy in Chile. So these are invaluable pieces of history. You do have to work hard to put them all together, kind of like a crossword puzzle. You need to have all the pieces, as many of the pieces as you can find, to really understand the full history. But once you have it, I think it's very potent. And that's what we tried to do in that book, The Pinochet File, is use those documents to build that historical narrative through the documents.
I think you did a great job with that, with creating that narrative. And I did think it was a really great choice to include the documents that you cited at the end of each chapter, especially.
Sure.
The version that I read, I actually had access through my college's library, had a hyperlink. So every time you would cite a document, you could click on it and it would take you to that document.
I love that.
That was great.
When the book first came out, that kind of option wasn't available, but now it is.
And so being able to see in real time where, you know, you reference a specific conversation, and instead of having to wait until, you know, 40 or 50 pages later, and being able to see, oh, it's right here. You know, I think it's kind of like an instant credibility, sort of, to someone who might be like a skeptical reader. Not saying I'm a skeptic, you know, obviously I didn't approach your book being, oh, is this guy telling the truth? But someone who might be less informed and maybe is more inclined to sort of believe that whitewashed narrative of, oh, America was trying to preserve capitalism and preserve democracy and, you know, fight the good fight against communism, which I think defines a lot of U.S. interventionism in Latin America during the Cold War, especially. And I think being able to give readers that kind of instant access to see where you're citing from. Just instantly, you know, hearing some of the most absurd, hearing such absurd things said by, you know, officials and saying, you know, this can't be, you know, they want themselves treated as heroes. And then you read about like the Letelier Moffett. Is that how you pronounce her last name?
Letelier and Ronnie Moffett.
Yeah. Letelier Moffett assassinations and seeing the responses to that. And that actually brings me to my next question. I wanted to kind of talk about the impact of the Letelier assassination, because that, you know, you dedicate a pretty significant, not a significant portion, but for one event, I think you give a pretty significant voice to that event and the impacts of that event in your book. And I wanted you to kind of go into why that is such a hallmark kind of factor in the Pinochet regime's sort of bouts of international terrorism.
Well, I mean, at the time, you have to remember that there was no history of international terrorism in Washington, D.C., the capital, you know, city of the United States of America. This was well before, 25 years before, you know, 9/11. And you had a friendly foreign government sending agents to capital city of the United States and planting a bomb under the car of the leading, you know, civil opponent of the Pinochet dictatorship, Orlando Letelier, who was a very prominent economist at the Inter-American Development Bank, worked at the Institute for Policy Studies right downtown on DuPont Circle. And this was an out-and-out international terrorist attack on specific individuals, you know, within earshot of the State Department and really right down the street from the White House. So it was a very bold, flagrant, and unpardonable atrocity. Nobody could ignore this. And the fact that it came from a government that Henry Kissinger and Gerald Ford were avidly supporting at the time was even more of a, you know, a shock and an eye-opener. And although it took a couple of years to prove that Pinochet had done this and that the Chileans were behind it. So the Letelier Moffett assassination did basically start to change the U.S. support for the Pinochet regime. It would dovetail with the election of Jimmy Carter just less than 2 months later, in November of 1976, who basically ran on a platform of human rights and repudiated the Nixon-Ford kind of policy of supporting dictators like Pinochet. And so it started a kind of an era of more distance between Washington and the military regime in Chile. That changed when Ronald Reagan defeated Jimmy Carter in the 1980 election and decided to return to an embrace of anti-communist dictatorships in the Southern Cone. But ironically, it was the Reagan administration that decided in kind of the mid-1980s that Pinochet was a liability because the longer he stayed, the more radical the situation was becoming in Chile. The left was getting more powerful precisely because Pinochet would not allow any political space for the centrist political parties, and for the civilians who were really quite tired of him. And his atrocities continued. At one point, his military personnel detained a young 19-year-old man named Rodrigo Rojas, somebody I had known since he was 11 years old when he lived in exile in Washington, and set him and a companion of his on fire for protesting against the regime, and burned him to death. And that was in July of 1986, and that helped kind of be one of the final nails in the coffin of kind of the outrages of the Pinochet era and the reaction of the United States. So there you have it. The Letelier assassination at that point was used by Secretary of State George Shultz, a Republican, to convince Ronald Reagan to just say goodbye, say adios, a Pinochet. And we have the declassified documents, which are absolutely stunning. It took a long time and a lot of work to get them. But we have the CIA report that Shultz asked for, reviewing all of its raw intelligence from the Letelier assassination in 1976, and basically coming to the conclusion that their sources told them at the time that Pinochet personally ordered this act of international terrorism. So George Shultz is then empowered with this CIA report to go into President Reagan's Oval Office and say, "We have to stop supporting this guy. Not only is he not letting democracy return, but he's a goddamn international terrorist. And he committed this crime, this act of terrorism, right in our capital. And he's supposed to be a friend of ours. And he did this. We shouldn't be supporting him. We should be indicting him." And this became a pretty strong argument to kind of push Ronald Reagan, past the point of wanting to embrace Pinochet and continue to support him because he was such a great anti-communist. And at one point, and we only know this because we have the declassified MemCon, Memorandum of Conversation, of a National Security Council meeting with Shultz and Reagan and every other top national security official in the U.S. government, in which Reagan says, "Well, okay, but maybe I could invite Pinochet to come to Washington for a state visit, and I could say, 'Thank you, General, for your great service to the West. Now it's time to retire.'" And Shultz responds, and you don't hear this very often from a Secretary of State talking to a president. He says, "No way, Mr. President." He literally says, "No way, Mr. President, are you going to invite Augusto Pinochet to Washington? That man has blood on his hands. He has done monstrous things." And these are the tidbits of history, if you will, that are so forceful and so powerful, and lead you to understand, how the whole evolution of the U.S. role and U.S. policy played out. The whole all the evidence against Pinochet as an international terrorist, and the impact that it had in the end of the United States government deciding to, basically say, "We're not going to support you anymore."
So in the wake of kind of this uncensored look at history that we get through these declassified documents, I guess my last question to you would be, how can we take the realities and truths that are revealed to us through those so many, what did you say, 23,000 declassified documents? How can we take those realities that are revealed to us, and that you kind of reveal in your book and apply those lessons to the future, just of American foreign policy, international relations, and I guess just parsing information just in the world.
Well, you know, I want to say, to your credit, this is what you're trying to do by just having a podcast that looks back on this history because you believe it's relevant to the current day. And I think that's what one has to do with history more and more and more. You have to find the opportunities to remind everybody about what happened in the past and why it's still relevant to know, why it's still relevant to be discussed. There's, you know, no end, unfortunately, to the tragedies, sadness, violations of power, abuses of power that go on in the world. And you know, I'm so sorry your generation has to face this instability and these outrages and the horrors that are happening in the Middle East and the Ukraine, et cetera. You know, in some ways, I feel like a failure of sorts because the world isn't really any better for the 50 years that I've been working to try and empower citizens with declassified information. But on the other hand, we have created models of getting the documents out, of using the documents for the current discussion. And that just happened during this 50th anniversary commemoration of the coup in Chile. My book was reissued, new documents in it. It created quite a stir in the press. Thousands of people bought the book. It was on the bestseller list. There was a whole special documentary called Operation Chile, Top Secret, that aired on mainstream Chilean television. A million people watched it. I was stopped in the street starting the next day by complete strangers, not because they wanted to like get their picture taken with me, but they wanted to say thank you for, you know, finally getting the truth out and into our hands. And it was clear that the program was successful on television. The book was successful because it played immediately into a debate that's taking place where the right wing is trying to whitewash and resurrect Augusto Pinochet and return to the Pinochet era. You know, the victims of his repression are trying to say, well, he was not a statesman and he was not a Democrat, and he did violate human rights and should be held accountable and not, you know, not depicted as some kind of, you know, benevolent, you know, civic leader, which he wasn't. So, you know, and that is relevant to our own country. We are facing the threat of what I call the allure of authoritarianism also. And that's why Donald Trump has kind of a diehard, you know, group of supporters who won't let go of him no matter what he does. That's why there's somehow out there, you know, at least the polls show 18 million Americans who think that violence against the Capitol on January 6th of 2021 was somehow justifiable when it was a coup attempt. Anti-democratic, and you know, and you see how the conditions for a coup could easily take place here in the United States, and that's a threatening thing. But you know, one uses the history in Chile, to try and build a bridge to a discussion about what's going on in a country like the United States or in other countries around the world. So you just seize the opportunity when it's there. The 50th anniversary of the coup was a global opportunity to have the discussion of dictatorship versus democracy. And I think a lot of people saw that opportunity, seized it, and did what they could with it. And I'm proud to be, you know, one of the thousands who worked on that issue and used that date to renew global attention to this struggle. And that's what your generation will have to do as it looks at history and tries to use history of the past to influence the future.
Those are some pretty potent words. But that's really why I started this podcast and why I'm such a believer in being knowledgeable of history, I think, in general. I see a lot of echoes of history looking at, you know, the coup attempt or the insurrection and January 6th, and the kind of ways that people are going about trying to destabilize American democracy on like social media, comparing it to the actions that the CIA took in like Chile and all these other Latin American countries at the time. But I think the one thing that's important really for you to hear is that you tried. And I think that is, at the end of the day, I think, the most valuable contribution you can make to this field. You know, change is not something that can happen instantly, and it may be so slow that we don't even recognize it's happening. But I think you put in such a great effort, such a concentrated effort to highlight this history and to make people aware of it. And you were clearly successful. So I don't think you I definitely think for you to feel like a failure is remiss, and I think dismissive of what you've accomplished.
All right, well, you can write my obituary when I'm no longer here and say those things and remind everybody of what I tried to do.
I'll be sure to have your estate contact.
I count you as a, since you've read the book, as a success for myself, and I'm glad you read it and are making good use of it.
Oh yeah, and I'm going to encourage people that I know and just classmates in general to make use of that book as well, because it was definitely it's a read I would recommend. Do you have any closing thoughts before you take off?
No, I kind of thought I had summed it up there before. And,
yeah. No, that was a pretty good ending point. Yeah.
You know, that's worth perhaps ending on those points. So go forth and good luck. And I hope the podcast proves to be one of these early projects and a long and productive life for yourself.
Thank you. All right. Well, this has been the History Section with Peter Kornbluh. I will see you guys in the next episode. Hey, if you made it this far, thanks for listening. And if you want to hear more, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or visit thehistorysection.com to catch future episodes.